Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Okay, we are continuing now with the study of the Satipatthana Sutta. This is Sutta number 10 in the Middle Length Discourses. And last time I went through the section number two, the section on the four postures for Iriyapata. That's page 146. Now we come on page 147, the section on, here is translated full awareness, but this is the Pali word sampajanya, which now I prefer to translate clear comprehension. I think that gives a better sense of what is involved. And we've already had this passage when we studied the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint simile, Chula Hati Padopama Sutta. But now, in this context, the same instructions take on a somewhat different meaning or different application. Okay, here the text says, again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu is one who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning. Or the Pali says, puna chaparang bhikkhave bhikkhu abhikante patikante. The key word here is sampajana kari hoti. This could be translated either one who acts with clear comprehension in going forward and returning, or one who practices clear comprehension in when going forward and returning. And so the key word here is the adjective sampajana. I've already explained this several times, and then it has a derivative noun, sampajanya, which I translate clear comprehension. The word derives from the root nya, which means to know. And then it's augmented by two prefixes, sam, which gives a sense of fullness or completeness, and pa, which can be taken to give the sense of different aspects. Sometimes it can also take the sense of excellence. But this is not yet, even though sampajanya is based upon a root meaning to know, we should not identify this necessarily with a higher state of wisdom. But this is, sampajanya is a kind of attitude that one takes to one's activities and experiences, which provides, I would call this the seed or germ out of which wisdom will arise. It's a way of viewing one's activities and one's experience in a thorough, clear, thorough, clear, comprehensive way, a way which is precise, analytical, and yet also takes account of relationships in which different one's activities and one's goals are the relationships in which one's activities, goals, purposes, and so on are set. The commentaries give a very useful explanation of different aspects of clear comprehension. They have a standard way of analyzing clear comprehension into four aspects. I mentioned these four earlier when I explained the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint, but it doesn't hurt to go through them again. Okay, by sattaka sampajanya, this means having, before one engages in any activity, one has a clear idea of the purpose of one's action. And one only will act in ways which are conducive to one's true benefit, to one's true welfare. And particularly for a practitioner of the Dhamma, this means that when one is considering undertaking a particular action, one reflects and contemplates whether undertaking this action will contribute to growth in the Dhamma or to decline, deterioration from the Dhamma. So in the case of going, the first case mentioned here, before going someplace, one considers, will going to this particular place be beneficial, be conducive to my growth and development in the Dhamma? Or will it be harmful, detrimental to my growth? Okay, the second aspect of clear comprehension, this is called sapaya sampajanya. This means once one is determined that pursuing a particular action is going to be conducive to one's growth in the Dhamma, then one determines what is the most suitable way to fulfill that goal. How can I go about pursuing that goal in a way that will be most effective? So this is making a choice of the proper means, what is the most appropriate means. And so one wants to choose a means also that will be, also when choosing the means to fulfill one's goal, one wants to choose a means, a method that is in harmony with the Dhamma. One doesn't choose a means of fulfilling a goal that is contrary to the Dhamma, even though one might think of pursuing some good, noble purpose that is in accord with the spirit of the Dhamma. But if you choose unsuitable means, then those means will be harmful to yourself. And so you have to reflect upon the means for example, somebody thinks it's very beneficial to make generous donations, to sponsor worthy causes, to practice charity. But if they engage in some kind of black market activity in order to earn money to make generous donations, then they are harming themselves. Even though they might think that they're doing something wholesome and meritorious by making donations, but if they're exploiting others, cheating others in order to get money to make donations, then they're sort of countering whatever merits they might get through the generosity by using unsuitable means to fulfill that purpose. Okay, then the third aspect of clear comprehension. Now it's the third and fourth aspects of clear comprehension that become especially relevant to the practice of satipatthana meditation. The first and second aspects, of course, they're also important, but they're concerned with the application of mindfulness to activities of everyday life. But it's the third and fourth aspects that are especially relevant to maintaining what we might call the consistency of the meditative frame of mind. The consistency, the continuity of the meditative state of mind. The third, it's called, okay, I'm using Pali words here, I'll explain them, Gocchara Sampajanya. Literally, it means clear comprehension of the object, or clear comprehension of the domain, the area. But what it's meant is keeping the meditation object in mind as continuously as possible throughout the activities of everyday life. This is especially intended for monastics who are engaged in full-time meditative training. The objective here, the aim, is to maintain the meditation object in mind in the midst of one's daily activities, so that the object does not slip away. So if somebody is practicing, say, mindfulness of breathing, of course, when they're sitting in meditation, then it's rather easy. Well, I can't say it's easy, but the breath is constantly available as the object. They're not engaged in other activities, so they can just sit and try to keep the mind focused upon the breath. But there come times when one has to get up, in the case of, say, in a monastery, to go on alms round. This is usually the case cited often in the commentaries. And so when going on alms round, one has to keep the mind in a meditative frame even throughout the entire alms round. It's very difficult going on alms round to keep the mind on the delicate point of focus of the breath right here. But it's taught that the meditating monk should always, when going on the alms round, keep the eyes focused just about 2 meters in front. Try to be constantly aware of the body, mindful of the body, have mindfulness set up on the body. Whenever one has to pause and stop, say, when one stops in front of a house to collect the alms, then one could bring the mind to the breath. When people come to bring, offer food, then one puts the breathing aside and one just radiates loving kindness to them when they offer the food. Then one moves on to the next house. One brings the mind back to the breath. And when people come to offer the food, one radiates loving kindness. On to the next house. As one is walking, keeping the mind on the breath, radiates as people bring the food, one radiates the loving kindness, and so on, till one finishes the round, say in a particular village. Here we don't have villages anymore. A particular village, township. Then when one is returning to the monastery, again, one brings the mind back to the body. Maybe now one is focusing on the walking, 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 till one comes back. Then when one is eating the meal, one is mindful, keeps the mindfulness on the eating. When one is cleaning up after the meal, one mindfully cleans up. And if one takes a rest, mindfully one takes the rest, again trying to bring the mind back to the breath. Then when one resumes the regular meditation practice, it becomes relatively easy to bring the mind back to the main meditation object. Whereas if one thinks, one is sitting in meditation, then one thinks, okay, meditation period is over, time to go on alms round, one just puts the meditation subject down and lets oneself think any thoughts, whatever. One just goes walking very casually. When one is making the rounds in the village, one just starts chatting with people, asking what is the news, what are you hearing on the radio, what is in the newspapers. Then the mind gets distracted, disturbed with many stray thoughts. And then when one comes back, one starts thinking, what did I get on the alms round? Oh, I got this, I like this, this I don't like, I could give this to that person. This is delicious, this not so good. And then starts eating quickly what one likes, discarding what one dislikes. Then one sits down to meditate on the breath again, and the mind is filled with all sorts of disturbing thoughts. Okay, so this is clear comprehension of the domain, which means keeping the main meditation subject constantly in mind as continuously as possible. If one can't keep the main subject in mind, one should always maintain this sort of protective coating of mindfulness around one, so that one never abandons mindfulness in the midst of one's activities. And whatever one does fully aware of what one is doing. Then it's the fourth aspect of clear comprehension. This is the especially important aspect in the development of wisdom. This is called clear comprehension of non-delusion. And this means that when one is engaging in any of these activities mentioned in the passage, going forward and returning, looking ahead, looking away or to the side, when flexing and extending the limbs, I think more natural to say bending and stretching the limbs, wearing the robes and carrying the outer robe and alms bowl, eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, even when defecating and urinating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, keeping silent. Okay, in all of these activities, one understands these activities in terms of the basic framework of, call it the basic framework for generating wisdom. One uses the basic, what I call the schemes or templates of the Buddha's teaching as means for kind of lens for viewing these activities and one analyzes these activities, not just intellectually, but this is experientially. One analyzes, experientially analyzes these activities in terms of these basic frameworks or schemes in order to penetrate their true nature. And especially what is intended is to penetrate the selfless nature of these activities. The nature of these activities is being devoid of any ego entity or self. I want to read some passages from the commentary and sub-commentary to, it comes in the commentary, sub-commentary to the Samanyapala Sutta in the Digha Nikaya, but it actually pertains to the, it's the commentary on the same passage on the practice of clear comprehension. So it also applies to the Satipatthana Sutta. Okay, this is, they're explaining clear comprehension of non-delusion in regard to going forward and returning. Okay, when going forward and returning, a monk does not become deluded about these actions like the ordinary worldly person who thinks a self goes forward. The action of going forward is produced by a self, or who thinks I go forward. The action of going forward is produced by me. Instead, the monk wisely understands when the thought, let me go forward, arises, the air element arises together with that thought, producing bodily activity. Here, this is in the ancient Indian system of physiology. The air element would correspond to what we might consider maybe neuro-transmitting signals. I'm not sure if I'm using the right physiological terms. But neurological signals that stimulate motor activity. They had to use the terminology that was available to them, so they spoke of it in terms of the air element. We would use the language of modern biochemistry to explain this. Okay, so through the diffusion of the air element originating from mental activity, this body goes forward. When going forward, this is interesting part, in each act of raising the foot, two elements are subordinate and weak, while the other two elements are predominant and strong. Okay, in raising the foot, the two elements that are dominant are the fire element and the air element. In fact, in raising the foot, the fire element is dominant, because fire goes against gravity, fire rises up. And the air element is its assistance, because fire burns oxygen. It requires air. When bringing the foot forward, then the air element becomes dominant and the fire element is its assistant. Because currents of wind move this way, horizontally. So the air element is seen as responsible for the movement of the foot forward. When dropping the foot, then the water element becomes dominant and the earth element becomes its assistant, because water flows downwards. And then when pressing the foot against the ground, as one shifts weight, then the earth element becomes dominant, and the water element becomes its assistant, because the earth element is the heaviest. Okay, so and now is understanding this act of walking in terms of the four primary elements. And one is seeing how what we call a walking body, the body, or how a person walking is really mental activity, intention, volition of walking, stimulating the nervous system in such a way that certain nerve currents transmit signals to parts of the body, cause those parts of the body to move, and thus the act of walking takes place. Okay, and then continuing this examination of the act of walking, using these schemes or principles of the Dhamma to investigate the act of walking, one could see when one is doing this mindfully with very close attention to the act of walking, one sees that in each stage of each step, the material and mental phenomena which occur in one stage do not reach the next stage, but they stop within that stage itself. So when one is lifting the foot up, the thought of lifting the foot up, this is actually a continuous sequence of thoughts and tensions of lifting, lifting, lifting. Many, many thoughts arise and perish, and many actions, or these are the material phenomena, rupa dhammas, physical phenomena, of lifting the foot occur in very rapid succession, each one little movement occurs followed by the next little movement, till the lifting of the foot reaches its zenith. Then when one is bringing the foot forward, at that time there are no more intentions of lifting the foot, no more physical action of lifting the foot, but now the intentions are bringing the foot forward, bringing the foot forward. Again, it's a sequence of volitions, a series of volitions, bringing the foot forward, 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 forward. And each time the foot is moving by little increments, so we see it as just the continuous movement of going forward. But when one is paying very close mindful attention, it's like I remember when we were kids, we used to buy these packs, cards of cards, where you have like a picture, and then they used to sell them like a deck of cards, and you flip through it, and they were almost identical except little changes taking place from one card to the next. And you flip through, you see like maybe a man appear on the left-hand side of the deck, and he moves across the deck as you're flipping through, till by the end of the deck, he gets on the right-hand side. Or maybe you see a picture of a mama walking with a baby, with a little child. They're walking across the deck. And it's just a series of individual cards, each one shows the mama with the child, slightly different position. But when you flip them, quickly it looks like a continuous movement right across the deck. And so when one pays very, very close attention to the act of walking, then it breaks up into the series of little movements, each one occurring and passing away right there on the spot. So the commentary continues. It says, when raising the foot, the material and mental phenomena which then occur do not reach the stage of bringing the foot forward. Similarly, those which occur when bringing the foot forward do not reach the stage of shifting it away. That's bringing the foot even further forward. Those which occur when shifting the foot away do not reach the stage of dropping the foot. Those which occur when dropping the foot do not reach the stage of placing it on the ground. And those which occur when placing the foot on the ground do not reach the stage of pressing it against the ground. So it seems to be a continuous movement of one self-existing continuous entity is actually a series of movements of a constantly, of not an identical entity, but a series of phenomena. And so the commentary continues, having come into being, section by section, phase by phase, stage by stage, these phenomena break up right on the spot, popping like sesame seeds thrown onto a hot pan. Who is the one that goes forward? To whom does the act of going forward belong? Ultimately, there is only the going of elements, the standing of elements, the sitting of elements, the lying down of elements. In each phase, together with the bodily form, one state of consciousness arises, another state of consciousness ceases. The process thus goes on in uninterrupted flow like a stream. Then the sub-commentary says, it's explaining that phrase, these phenomena break up right on the spot. It says, wherever they have arisen, just there they break up. For phenomena do not move from one region to another. The moment during which even material phenomena occur is extremely brief. And just as the breakup of sesame seeds is characterized by the popping sound they make when they break up, so too for the arising of conditioned phenomena. But then the sub-sub-commentary has to say, conditioned phenomena, of course, do not actually make a popping sound when they arise and break up. But just as the popping sound is the characteristic indicating the breakup of sesame seeds, so arising is the characteristic indicating the breakup of conditioned phenomena, since once they have arisen, they invariably break up. Okay, so this clear comprehension now, first, especially in regard to the practice of Satipatthana, especially here, the practice of clear comprehension of the range, that is, keeping the meditation subject constantly in mind, keeping the attitude of mindfulness constant, continually set up, and then using the mindful, sharpened mind in order to investigate the experience, the activities, and be able to see them not as the actions of a continuing self or person, but as the play, the interplay of mental and material phenomena, which are mutually conditioning, always arising and passing away. okay, and this is to be done in all of these activities. There's a little problem in regard to the last one, but let me just go through some of these. Okay, one applies this full awareness or clear comprehension in going forward and returning. Even in looking ahead and looking away or to the side, that is one who is practicing this mindfulness and clear comprehension will generally keep the eyes focused within a narrow range. When he has to look up for some purpose, he will have an awareness of the purpose of looking up or to the side. He won't allow the eyes just to go looking around anyway. Anything interesting attracts the attention, and the head is moving left or right. Okay, when one has to bend or stretch the limbs for some reason, again, one contemplates the reason for bending and stretching the limbs, and one does so mindfully. There's a story that comes down in the commentaries. Once there was an elder monk who was teaching his pupils, and as he was teaching, he bent his arm out this way. Then suddenly he hesitated in his talking. Then he took his arm, brought it back to the same position, then brought it back in again, slowly and mindfully. Then his pupils asked him, "Venerable Sir, why did you just stop and put your arm back out there and then bring it back in again?" And he said, "Well, for the last so many years, every motion that I've been making, I've been doing with clear comprehension. But just now, as I was talking, I got a little carried away and I bent my arm in without clear comprehension. But as soon as I realized that, I put my arm back into the same position and then brought it back in mindfully." Okay, then putting on the robes, in this case, in ordinary life, putting on clothes. When eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting, this is very important because this helps one get a sense of how much one really needs in order to be healthy. There comes an inner sense that will tell you that just this much is enough. I don't really have to continue to fill myself to enjoy the taste. And so when one trains oneself with mindfulness, practicing mindful eating, then one develops what I call this internal monitor, which will tell you just this much is enough. And this much is not the point where you're full to capacity and can't fit anything in anymore. But it's the point where it said where the stomach is about 2/3 full. So then it said one should, if one wants to, one should drink water. And then that should be enough. Then one should maintain this clear comprehension even when going to the toilet, defecating and urinating. Then the last paragraph or last sentence is intended to cover what are called very short movements. Just when making a quick walk, getting up and walking just a few steps. Then when standing still, in the act of sitting down. Now, literally, for the next one, the text says, sutte sampajanakari hoti, which would have to mean, in sleep, one is practicing clear comprehension. Well, literally, it actually means having slept, one practices clear comprehension. But it's not possible to practice. Well, it's generally not possible to practice clear comprehension within sleep itself, because in sleep one is unconscious. So it's said that those who have really strong samadhi and very, very well-developed sampajanya can maintain that clear comprehension even in sleep. But for an ordinary practitioner, that's not possible. So I think in translating this, I'm not sure whether this came from Venerable Nyanamoli or whether I had phrased it in that way. What seems to be the only meaningful way to take, or one of the only meaningful ways to take it, when falling asleep, when lying down, about to fall asleep, one tries to maintain the clear comprehension through the process of falling asleep. Till one goes, then the clear comprehension goes. So it could also mean, if one takes sutte as the past participle, that when one wakes up, one is aware that one has just slept. And one is also aware of having woken up the next one. Then when one is talking, one is clearly comprehending the purpose of talking. This will stop one from engaging in a lot of idle chatter, gossip, unwholesome speech. And then when one keeps silent, then one is aware that one is silent. And then paragraph 9 applies the same, that insight passage in paragraph 5, to everything here. Except generally, I think paragraph 9, this contemplating the body as a body internally, externally, both. Here, we have to indicate that one is observant. One can't really contemplate the bodies of others in all of these activities, but it would seem to mean that one is observant of what others are doing. So when one knows when others are walking, what kind of activities other people are engaged in one's immediate environment, so one will be responsive to their activities, will not encroach upon their domains, not interfere with them. One will be able to harmonize with them. Maybe at this point I'll ask if there are any questions. Okay, Peter?
Are we talking about he's fully aware of these things that he's doing, or because you also said previously he was fully aware of the meditation on it while he's doing anything?
Yeah, especially in regard to going forward and returning, or even in the midst of these activities. Of course, when one engages in these activities, then as one enters into them, one has to sort of temporarily put the meditation subject aside. Say if one is dressing, in the case of a monk putting on the robe, it's a little difficult if one is doing mindfulness of breathing, especially the way we have to roll up our robe sometimes, to be focusing on the breath while trying to roll the robe or to adjust the robe. Or if you're putting on a tie, to make a tie while being mindful of breathing. So one has to put the subject aside, but still one engages in that activity with clear comprehension of what one is doing. But as soon as one doesn't have to invest one's attention in that other activity, one immediately brings the meditation subject up to the forefront of the mind again.
So it seems that the way that most people use mindfulness, the lay teachers, is really something done. When someone says, be mindful of washing the dishes, what they're really talking about is full awareness.
Well, you see, mindfulness and sampajanya, they go together very, very closely. So, although they're distinct, it becomes almost impossible to separate them. So let us say washing the dishes. I would say that mindfulness here is the attentiveness to the activity. Sampajanya, clear comprehension, is knowing what one is doing. First, okay, one has some sense of the purpose of what one is doing. That would be sattva sampajanya. Suitability, this doesn't really arise since here the activity is fixed. Though maybe clear comprehension of suitability, washing the dishes, when we'd have to make sure that there's right amount of water, right kind of dishwashing soap. Okay, then gochara sampajanya. Okay, here let's say when it's put the main meditation subject aside, when it's just attending to washing the dishes, when it's doing it mindfully, that is, when it's attending to each aspect of the task. And because one is keeping one's mind on this activity, this is a kind of gochara sampajanya, clearly comprehending the object, not letting the mind stray, wander astray. And one could be applying non-delusion to this. Again, thinking, or not just thinking, but if the mind is really focused, one could be experiencing that these are just states of consciousness arising with volition, wash this dish, then that intention arises, wash this dish. In fact, the intention is not really to wash the dish, but move the arm. Okay, first the intention arises, that stimulates the arm to move, the arm is moving, the eye is seeing, watching the dish, then there'll come another consciousness, noticing the dish is dirty, then successive acts of consciousness, noticing the dish is getting cleaner, 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 till an act of consciousness arises, noticing the dish is clean, then another intention arises, put the dish under the water to rinse it, then in obedience to that volition, the left arm will put the dish under the water, another act of eye consciousness arises, watching the water run over the dish, washing the soap away, another volition arises, turn the dish over. Another eye consciousness watches the water wash the soap off the dish. Another volition arises, turn the dish back to the front side till you're rinsing it front, back side several times. Then when the eye consciousness convinces one that the dish is washed and rinsed, there will come a volition, put the dish back on the dish rack, and that materializes itself by a volition, lift the arm with the dish, suppose the dish rack is on the right, so you're lifting the dish, put it down on the dish rack, open the arm, and someone is breaking this act up into a series of acts in which there are volitions, intentions, acts of consciousness, witnessing this. First, acts of volition, motivating bodily activities, and acts of consciousness, witnessing this, at certain points, ascertaining that the desired end has been achieved. So in this way, one is able to investigate and to analyze this action into a series of bodily and mental phenomena arising and passing away in succession. Any further questions? Okay, let us take the act of washing dishes again. The volition saying, let me wash this dish, that belongs to the aggregate of volitional formations, sankhara khanda. That volition stimulates bodily action, the bodily action of taking the dish, putting it under the water, this bodily action that's part of the rupa khanda, the form aggregate. As one is washing, one is sort of notices first the dish is dirty. That is perception aggregate. But it's the perception aggregate working through visual consciousness, eye consciousness. So there's the consciousness aggregate there. When one sees the dirty dish, one gets an unpleasant feeling. That's the aggregate of feeling. As the dish is getting clean, one is noticing it getting clean. Again, that's the perception aggregate working together with the aggregate of consciousness. When the dish is clean, then one perceives it as clean. Then one gets a pleasant feeling. That's the aggregate of feeling. And then one has the volition, the intention, let me put the dish back on the dish rack. That's the aggregate of volitional formations. And the consciousness of all this action, that is the aggregate of consciousness. Okay, Ken.
Those four kinds of sampajanya, do they occur one time or one at a time?
I would say the first two tend to come at different times. They don't come simultaneously. The third... The third and fourth work very closely together. The fourth depends upon the third, since that kind of very close, what I would call almost a microscopic ability to focus in microscopically upon one's experience and see it in terms of these mental and material phenomena, that skill depends upon maintaining the meditation object consistently and continuously so that it builds up the, so that one's mindfulness builds up continuously over time, over a period of time. And it's when the mindfulness builds up that one's attention becomes very finely focused, that one could tune in to very subtle aspects of experience and observe them and notice them at subtle levels. Okay, I want to go on and try to cover the next aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta. This is called, here it's called foulness. I don't think I would use that rendering now, since the Pali is asubha, which simply means unbeautiful. So now I think I would use the unattractive nature of the body. And this meditation, it's recommended especially for monastics in order to overcome, to help reduce and to overcome sensual desire. And what this involves is taking a very close examination of the body in terms of its constituent parts. And so the text says, here again a monk reviews this same body up from the soles of the feet. That is, one takes this body beginning from the soles of the feet and going upwards to the top of the head. Then one starts from the top of the hair. So nowadays we don't have too much of that left anymore. top of the hair, goes down to the soles of the feet, bounded by skin, as full of many kinds of impurity. Here it doesn't mean moral impurity, but just things that are unattractive, not beautiful or lovely when one looks at them individually. And one reflects, in this body there are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin. These five things are actually, when one sees a person, these are the five things that one sees. When one looks at a person's body, what one sees are head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, and skin. But then, when one looks beneath the skin, one comes to flesh or muscles. Then it's called naharu, which are the sinews or tendons. Then come the bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver. Then what's translated here, diaphragm, but I think it's actually maybe more accurately rendered as the pleura. These are membranes that cover the organs. Spleen, lungs, intestines, mesentery, then the stomach together with its contents, feces, then later texts add another organ after the feces, the brain, to make 32 parts. The older texts only have 31 parts. Okay, and those that I just mentioned, 20 parts are solid parts of the body, which are taken to represent the earth element. Now come 12 liquid parts: bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. Then the text gives a simile. It is just as though there were a bag with an opening at both ends, full of many sorts of grain, hill rice, red rice, beans, peas, millet, and white rice, and a man with good eyes were to open it and review it thus. He would review the different types of grain in there. So too a monk reviews the same body as full of many kinds of impurity thus. In this body there are head hairs, and so on up to urine. Yeah, I want to speak a little bit about the way this meditation subject is taught and practiced. Okay, here we have, including the brain, we would have 32 parts. But it's said that when one learns the meditation subject, what one does is to break these 32 parts up into groups, and one goes through them mentally, taking them by groups and expanding as one goes through. I'll explain how this is done. Okay, first one takes five of the parts, and one goes in forward and backwards order. Head hairs, body hairs, nails, teeth, skin. Then one goes backwards, skin, teeth, nails, body hairs, head hairs. One has to learn the parts come to be familiar with them, with these outer parts, of course, that's relatively easy. The problem is to get, how does one get familiar with the inner parts? In the days of the Buddha, what the monks would do, they were what they called charnel grounds, where when criminals were executed, they would just take them to the charnel grounds, throw them away. And there would be people, sort of low caste or outcast men who would hang around the charnel grounds, and I don't know, they would cremate the bodies for a fee from relatives. And so monks would go there to the charnel grounds, and some of these low caste men, they would have knives, and the monk would request to see the inside of the body. They would cut open and show the monks the organs of the body. Sometimes wild animals would come, start devouring the body, and then when we get a chance, and then abandon it, and when we get a chance to see what's on the inside. Nowadays, if one just wants to remain content with pictures, one could get book of anatomy, physiology, look at the pictures. What we used to do in Sri Lanka, you see, in the hospitals, there's what they call the mortuary, and the doctor in charge of the mortuary who performs the autopsy very often is a very devout Buddhist. And so we, as the monks, would go to the mortuary and we would say to the doctor, would it be possible for me to be present in the mortuary this morning when you perform some autopsies? And they would usually say, you're quite welcome, sir. Could prepare a chair. I remember one doctor who was familiar with this meditation of 32 parts as he was performing the autopsy for me. Not my autopsy. He would like pull out the part and say, this is the liver. Pull out the spleen. This is the spleen. These are large intestines. Like, can you show me where the small intestines ends and the large intestines begin? Okay, so in this way you get familiar with the parts and you get some visual image of them. Okay, so then you perform this exercise, you go through the first five parts, head hairs to skin, skin back to head hairs, then you go forward again, head hairs to skin, then you expand, go flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys. Then back, kidneys, bone marrow, bones, sinews, flesh. Actually, the Visuddhimagga instructions say to go back from flesh to head hairs and then to go forward again all the ways, but I don't agree with that. So it's rather arrogant of me not to agree with such an authoritative text. But my opinion is that when you do it that way, you're taking the first five parts, you're taking many, many times, and the parts that come at the end, you're only taking once. Whereas when you do it in the way that I prefer, then you're giving equal weight to each set of parts. So you go from head hairs to skin. Then you go from flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow to kidneys, then from kidneys back to flesh, then from flesh forward to kidneys, then the next group, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs. Then backwards, lungs, spleen, diaphragm, liver, heart, then forward, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, then forward, intestines, mesentery, contents of the stomach, feces, brain, then back, brain, feces, stomach, mesentery, intestines, then forward, intestines to brain, then include bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, sweat, fat, then backwards, fat, sweat, blood, pus, phlegm, bile, then forward, bile to fat, then tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine, then back from urine to oil of the joints, lubricating oil, snot, spittle, grease, tears, then forward again from tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, and urine. And that way, each part gets an equal number of hits. I think that's the computer terminology. Okay, so the commentarial method says first, okay, you get a clear idea of the color, shape of each of the parts. You have to know where it's located, what surrounds it. Then you take the parts, you go do a verbal recitation first. You're reciting it verbally, picturing the part to yourself. Not simply picturing it in your mind's eye, but you're locating it in your body, and you're aware that this is what my body is, collection of these parts. And you're viewing it from the aspect of its unattractiveness. If you take all of these parts, lay them out on the table in front of you, peel off the skin, put it here, pull out all of the fingernails, put them there, pull out all of the hairs, cut off the head hairs, put them there, shave off the beard, put it there, take out heart, liver, lungs, intestines, pile of blood here, pile of phlegm here, pot of phlegm here, pot of urine there. Not very beautiful, not very attractive. And so put it all together again, and we say, this is me. And so when you do this methodically, it sort of breaks this infatuation with one's own body, and the one who really wants to get liberation, who will break the bond of sensual lust that keeps one bound to the round of rebirths. I think there's more to say about this, but I think I should leave it for next week. Otherwise, I'll have to go too quickly, and then that would not do justice to the subject. Are there any questions? So if there's any questions, touch on what I will cover next week, then I'll just put it off till next week. But any questions on what I've explained so far? No questions. Of course.
See, kind of clear comprehension, like a routine, you have to clear understand what you are doing every moment. And if it becomes a routine, and in case if you forget something, what are you going to do? Like, because it's like a routine, sometimes the mind will wander.
One of the objectives of practicing the clear comprehension is to prevent the mind from wandering. But naturally one will, since we're not yet skilled practitioners, the mind wanders and we forget things. Then when one remembers, then one just has to get whatever one has forgotten or correct what one has forgotten. That's all. Just what we do under ordinary circumstances. no different. But if one gets into the habit of practicing this clear comprehension, it, especially with the mindfulness, one of the meanings of mindfulness, sati, is also memory. So it improves the memory. It makes stronger impressions on the memory, so one is less inclined to forget things. Dr. Murray.
In the meditation practice, the mindfulness there, can that be exercised in the same way to gently bring the wandering mind back, or is it a more strenuous exercise, effort at concentration?
I didn't quite understand the question.
There are competing views of what the meditation or meditation is meant to be.
Yeah.
And one view is that it's an intense form of concentration.
Yeah.
And another is that it's the kind of gentle bringing awareness back that you just...
Yeah. I see, that's the question whether it... I would say meditation, it's never a matter of forcefully concentrating the mind. Even though this word concentration is used as a rendering for samadhi, but it doesn't mean that samadhi results from a forceful effort to focus the mind. In fact, forcefulness is detrimental to samadhi rather than beneficial. So often one has to make an effort. Effort is necessary, but the effort should be to keep the mind as soft and gentle as possible while it is observing its object. Forcefulness is what makes concentration difficult. It's detrimental to concentration. But it's the softness and gentleness in the application of attention that brings success and concentration.
It seems to me there's nearly an infinite number of things going on within any activity.
Yeah.
Just washing a dish, we can break that down
to
ridiculous levels. And it seems that it would be impossible for the mind to keep up. So I'm wondering if the goal is to just develop that habit of noticing things continuously.
This is a good point. This is a very good point. This is a very good point, and I have to clear this up, that this fine focusing of attention, which leads to this clear comprehension of processes taking place at these very subtle levels, is not something that one can force the attention, force into one's field of attention, but rather as mindfulness builds up momentum, builds up a kind of continuity through being, continuously developed over a long period, then naturally it becomes sensitive to events taking place at finer and finer, subtler and subtler levels, so that one is able to notice what is taking place at finer levels. And in, say, the act of washing dishes, generally one would... I was maybe exaggerating a little bit in breaking it up into all the different components. Not when washing the dishes, one would generally not be dissecting it into all of those components, but one would just be mindfully washing the dishes in order to finish washing the dishes, but trying to maintain a continuity of mindfulness and being clearly comprehending of what one is doing in a general way. But in the basic actions of, say, sitting meditation with using... when one is developing insight, and especially when doing the walking meditation, walking back and forth, one is able to observe these processes taking place at very, very subtle levels, till, as I said, even within a single phase of a step, like lifting the foot, one could actually feel and experience in one act of lifting each little volition taking place to lift the foot, and the movement of lifting taking place almost in micro divisions of an inch, sort of taking place almost like very, very fine phases of an inch, so that it's not like one continuous act, but it's a series of discrete rupa dhammas, material phenomena, arising and passing away, arising and passing away.
So would you say we're letting the mind achieve its own resolution?
Through maintaining the mindfulness. And of course one has to, when the mindfulness becomes able to focus at these subtle levels, then one brings in this, what I call this, these analytical schemes to understand the experience. That requires some deliberate effort to understand the experience in terms of aggregates, elements, sense bases, or other schemes. Then that becomes useful as, I call it, a template for understanding one's experience.
So we don't do that until we've achieved a certain level of...
One could start doing it at a grosser level, but one is not able to focus it in on very subtle levels. Mm-hmm. I can only take one question, then we have to stop. Okay, so if we have a visitor, I'll let...
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Yeah. I was thinking exactly the same thing that Peter was thinking when he raised that question, because it's really a function of your level of education and enlightenment and understanding. Mm-hmm. Which is the limit for which you can break down these functions.
Yeah.
I mean, we can get into the subatomic levels. Of activity.
Yeah.
And the other issue is that when you were talking about the foulness of the bodily parts, if you contrast that with the Abrahamic view of these being creations of a deity.
Yeah.
Some kind. It's very interesting that the Buddhist view is that the very same organs that are viewed as miraculous are now foul.
Yeah, I don't like the word foulness now.
But that's what's written in the book.
Yeah, the word is actually asubha, which means non-beautiful.
Well, by the same token, you could look at all those parts as a wonderful integration.
Yeah.
It forms this magnificent system.
Yeah, one can look at that from that way too.
Right.
And I have to say,
look at it as a colony of cells.
Yeah. And I have to say that this viewing of the body as non-beautiful, it's not a theoretical judgment passed on the body, but it's set up for a practical purpose, and that is for diminishing pride in regard to one's own body and diminishing sensual desire.
Continue with this reduction. Ultimately at the universe of one. If these parts break down into infinitesimally small components, that brings it back to the original state.
Yeah. Okay, I think we have to stop now, because we're getting late, and stop by sharing the merits. Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang rakantu desanam akasata chabumata devanaga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam tavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu